The Kel'Thican gave the final instructions, speaking in a voice that carried to both sides.
Attackers win if they reclaim the banner and return it. Defenders win if the attacking army is destroyed. Additionally, the defenders win immediately if Alara is disabled.
At this, a number of the people on her team looked at her appraisingly. She scowled and ignored them, focused on the fluttering banner she could barely see above several of the obstacles across the field. Hyrel gave his orders, speaking low. He directed the infiltrators to advance in two groups first, to draw attention and then pull back. The strikers would take to the high ground of a hill fronted by low hedges and fire on any pursuit, then close with the foe to engage them and create an opening. Hyrel and his hand-picked lieutenants would try for the banner. Alara was to stay back behind the strikers and provide support, using her Myrmidon to shore up the line, then cover Hyrel's withdrawal once he got the banner. Alara disliked the notion of being held in reserve. Hyrel's plan was not entirely bad, but was not aggressive. She couldn't imagine the defenders would be lured out. They had no reason to leave their positions. The order for her to stay back was clearly motivated by his fear of losing the match prematurely. This effectively put her in a similar position as the banner on the other end of the field, an objective, not a member of the team. She drew her blades and mentally directed the griffin to advance as the others rushed silently forward, the infiltrators keeping low and to the cover afforded by some of the obstacles on their side of the field. The strikers crouched down behind the bundles of twigs intended to represent foliage atop the low hill that offered a view over the central corridor. The mage hunters communicated silently by hand gestures with one another, coordinating well. Alara's attention was focused on her Myrmidon as her teammates moved into position. She controlled her breathing and drew on her training from the third chamber, seeking a calm serenity apart from the tension of this clash. She let her thoughts ripple outward as she had been taught, making use of her Myrmidon's senses as well as the subtler awareness of her surroundings afforded by her newly awakened arcane abilities. She had a moment of clarity as she felt the looming presence of hostile forms behind the nearest screening obstacle, blades at the ready. The opposing team had established a forward defense, she realized. Rather than spreading their numbers across their territory or keeping a reserve closer to the banner, a sizable force waited in ambush for her team's advancing infiltrators. The sense of them faded the moment she tried to concentrate. She moved forward and around the hill, blades in either hand, then gave a high, short whistle to get Hyrel's attention. Hyrel looked back at her, his expression showing his annoyance at her giving away her position. She rapidly signaled danger ahead and halt advance. The gesture language used by the mage hunters was capable of conveying complex information, but not always quickly, so she kept it simple. She then signaled she would be advancing to support the infiltrators. Hyrel gave a sharp gesture of negation and emphatically pointed for her to move back to the strikers, then turned and continued on, not bothering to pass her warning to the others. Alara gritted her teeth and instead ran forward, feeling her legs empowered by her Worcester armor. She wasn't about to let the forward arm of the team be slaughtered while she did nothing. She belatedly remembered her griffin and mentally compelled it to advance as well. She diverted some of her arcane reserves to empower the arcanical device primed to release a surge of power to the Myrmidon's legs. It sped forward with sudden acceleration. As she had foreseen, the infiltrators on the other team were already in motion, vaulting over the barrier and landing among her teammates who had sought to take them unaware. Meanwhile, a group of opposing strikers shifted forward, exposing their position but gaining good angles of fire on the forward elements of Alara's team. The center of the field became a confusing mass of attacking mage hunters with blunted blades in each hand, striking to deliver telling marks on their foes. The padded elements of their blades had been soaked in dye before the match, making it easy to see solid hits revealed on dark leather armor as orange slashes and streaks. Those painted sufficiently were considered fatalities and directed to abandon the field. Several of Alara's infiltrators were slashed before they could even attempt to retaliate, their chests marked with what were unmistakably fatal blows. Alaris Griffin waded into the fight to shore up that line, blocking incoming attacks with its wide shield before retaliating with glancing strikes of its halberd. The Myrmidon had been given extensive conditioning to avoid committing its full strength against trainees, but confronting it was daunting nonetheless. The mage hunters were nimble opponents, and Alara did not have the attention to spare to guide its swings personally, which made them easier to evade. The halberd was a heavy weapon, however, so anyone it struck was considered dead no matter how oblique the blow. Even without her helping the machine, she hoped it could keep several foes occupied. Alara spared no more attention for the machine, for she was among the enemy with her blades. She felt a sudden rush of adrenaline as she did what she knew best. She saw the fear in the faces of the infiltrators as she grinned and struck them down. She scored orange-dyed gashes across the neck of one, then ducked beneath an incoming thrust from another to his right, her power field shimmering as the weapon was deflected. With another slash, that enemy was down, and she found herself fighting back-to-back with one of the infiltrators on her team, her griffin still entangling several enemies to the side. She was too busily engaged to watch Hyrel, although she could hear him shouting in frustration, desperately trying to salvage his plan. He was rallying the strikers to abandon the hill and advance to provide fire support. Meanwhile, he and his lieutenants rushed for the banner. The center of the field was a frenetic melee as what seemed to be the entire opposing team converged on Alara. A sudden and savage joy filled her as she intercepted incoming blades and knocked them aside even as she delivered killing retaliation. She did not strike as swiftly or as often as she might have, reserving her arcane power to overboost the power field that was deflecting incoming blunted crossbow bolts. She fell into a battle trance, and for a few long, glorious moments, she felt invincible. Several short orange lines were marked on her vambraces from glancing blows of incoming blades, but by the rules of the match, she could safely ignore them. Her armor and power field made it considerably more difficult for an enemy to deliver lasting injury to her, as only blows to her torso counted. She arguably had an unfair advantage, since eventually the strikers and infiltrators would earn traditionally attuned and purified weapons that would enable them to ignore a warcaster's power field. Alara was fully willing to exploit the situation to her benefit. From the corner of her eye, she saw Hyrel reach the banner and seize the pole. All she had to do was hold out. At some point during the fight, she had lost her situational awareness. She felt the void at her back. The infiltrator behind her had been cut down. She began to turn, but stumbled as a heavy thrust made it through her power field and smashed into the space below her backplate, digging into her spine. She regained her balance, but was struck several more times, parrying only one of the incoming strikes. Her griffin had begun to move in her direction, but too late. She realized at once she should have brought it nearer earlier. She had forgotten the Myrmidon among the press of the melee.
"Ilara is down,"
Keldeacon Sinvis declared loudly, ending the match. He stood just yards from her position, though Alara had not even realized he was near. Her cheeks burned.
"Match to the defenders. Well fought. Both teams, assemble and attend to me."
Hyrel gave her a fierce glare and hurled the banner pole to the grass. He had been more than halfway back, but she had lost the match before he could secure his triumph. Looking around at her team, she saw that most bore the orange slashes of injuries and had been forced to quit the field. The opposing team had nearly as many casualties, not that it mattered. She felt some small satisfaction at the number she knew bore marks from her weapons. The other team was in high spirits, clapping one another on the shoulders and smiling as they assembled near the Caldecan. Ilara's team was quiet and grim, and there was a decided distance between Alara and the nearest mage hunters. Several spoke quiet words of reassurance to Hyrel and shot angry looks her direction. Alara gritted her teeth and ignored them, bracing for the Caldecan's words.
"Both teams fought well, and I can see the impact of your training," he began. "These exercises are useful to demonstrate how quickly the reality of battle can change. We will be enacting more elaborate scenarios in the weeks ahead, ones intended to more closely simulate situations you may encounter on missions. This exercise was about fighting as a team and adapting.
He turned his hawk-like eyes to Alara, and it required a force of will not to look away from the intensity of his stare.
Alara, you made several critical mistakes, but your instincts were solid. Perceiving your team in peril, you acted courageously to support them. However, you neglected your Myrmidon. You still struggle to fight with it as though of one mind. I expected better.
Other times, she had felt compelled to argue with his assessment, but this time she knew he was right. She inclined her head, accepting the rebuke.
Additionally, you could have employed offensive magic to eliminate at least one enemy before you closed. Why did you not?
I did not believe I could spare the energy from my power field, Kaldikin, not while closing with the foe.
This was partially true, but she had also not felt confident in her ability to manifest the runes quickly while controlling the griffin. His gaze lingered on her another second, just long enough so she knew he saw through her small deception. Then he turned to the others. He spoke to the leader of the opposing team, noting the strategy employed had been risky, if ultimately successful. He noted that this had resulted in high casualties. Then he faced Tyrell and said,
Alara warned you, but you did not heed her.
His back stiffened, and Tyrell said, She did not explain the situation, and seemed mostly intent on disobeying her orders. Alara felt a rush of anger, but forced herself not to protest. The Keldeacon said,
There is a reason warcasters are usually given operational command in a combat engagement. I engineered this match to underscore that. Once they are versed in their talents, a warcaster has a unique perspective on the battlefield, an awareness that cannot be matched. An ordinary commander, no matter how capable, can rely only on his personal senses and the reports of subordinates. His task is to make the best decisions possible amid the fog of war. A skilled warcaster can neutralize that disadvantage. In a life-or-death situation, a warcaster may not have the time to explain what she has sensed, but must act. This does not mean she is always right. Far from it. We all make mistakes, and others may die because of them. Nonetheless, a warcaster must learn to trust her instincts, to assess the threat, and to act. Those fighting alongside her must trust those instincts as well, as hesitation invites disaster. Alara made mistakes today, but so did you, Hyrule. Ultimately, your pride did your team more harm than Alara's disobedience. Meditate upon that.
Hyrule bowed his head, his ears red. Yes, Kaldikin, thank you for the lesson. The phrase was picked up by the others, and Sinvis inclined his head slightly in return, and then dismissed them. Myalir was waiting for her as she left the field. He joined her in returning to the armory where her armor and weapons would be stowed. She felt the familiar loathing as he stepped beside her, as she could see his disapproving frown. More than anything, she did not wish to hear his opinion on the engagement, but she knew it was inevitable.
I think Hyrule was right about you, he said at last, when they were inside and beginning to remove her armor.
Of course you do, she replied.
You wanted to be in the middle of the fight, even knowing your loss would sink the team. You were reckless. You must begin to understand that your life is more important than others.
This was a different tack, and she turned to face him, surprised. His tone was bitter, but there was a strange earnestness beneath it. She asked,
So you would stand back knowing others would fall because you did not intervene? You would accept their deaths?
I will never be in a position to make that call, he said.
Again, his naked sincerity caught her off guard.
You are a warcaster, I am not. You are more valuable to the Retribution than everyone else training in this fortress. Yet you cannot master the simplest tasks beyond fighting. You cannot learn proper tactics, or how to use your magic, or control your Myrmidon. It is a waste. The gods are fickle. You will never be ready for the Crucible.
Alara felt rage building within her. He seemed to realize he had gone too far and stopped. Alara's hand was on one of her blades, the tendons in her forearm tensed. It took an effort of will not to draw. Even with that restraint, she knew she could kill him so easily. Arcane runes flashed before her mind's eye. She could gather her will in an instant to send a searing bolt of killing energy and end him. His eyes widened and he took a step back, looking down to her arm. She thought he was looking at her blade, but realized glowing runes had begun to manifest around her wrist. She let the power go, horrified at her lapse of discipline. She could see shock and fear in his eyes. He knew he had come close to death. In an instant, by mere thought, she might have killed him. Perhaps this should have made her feel better, but it did not. She felt miserable, all the more so because his words rang true. She turned her back to him and continued to unbuckle her armor as if nothing had happened. He assisted her in removing the plates, without another word. She pretended not to notice his hands were shaking. She considered his mention of the crucible, the final trial given aspiring Tyros. She knew little about it other than it was a difficult ordeal whose outcome determined whether a novice warcaster could enter the field to perform real missions. It was a trial she both eagerly anticipated and dreaded. She had at least one more year of training before being subjected to it, time she would not squander. She had to work harder and prove them all wrong. 2 weeks later, she began feeling she was being haunted by a ghost. She kept feeling eyes upon her, and as she went about her lessons, there was the sensation of familiarity, of half-glimpses of someone she knew. She found her heart beating wildly for no reason, even when resting between sparring matches. The distraction drove her to make mistakes against an easy opponent, allowing him to score several points before she finished him. She wondered where her mind was. She was just returning from the short reprieve of the midday meal when she turned a corner and almost walked into a slim-hooded woman who did not make way for her. Alara frowned and looked up to a pair of familiar eyes. The woman stood with arms crossed as if in challenge, but her eyes were bright, and she gave a sudden smile.
"Jairus!"
Alara exclaimed in surprise, feeling a sudden wave of affection and warmth. Jairus laughed, and they briefly embraced. The other woman was dressed in attire that superficially resembled that of the mage hunters, but a number of indicators displayed her allegiance to the third chamber, including the subtle way the symbol of Lilas was threaded in black embroidery into the pattern of her gray armor. Ilara's eyes widened to see the coiled chain blade attached to a clasp loop at her side, its sharpened edge sheathed.
"You are named now?"
"Yes. And here at the hold for my final training. I still prefer to wield the Clivishnar, but the chainblade has its place."
She paused and then said,
"It does me good to see you, Alara. You've changed. But I suppose so have I."
She pulled back her hood to show her shaved head, atop which had been inscribed several tattooed patterns, oaths of vengeance.
"Your hair!"
Alara exclaimed, watching Jairus chuckle and then turn her head to either side for closer examination. A number of mage hunters and others affiliated with the Retribution chose to cut their hair away to demonstrate their fidelity to the cause, their disinterest in anything that would distract them.
"I see you have not embraced this tradition,"
Jairus teased, reaching up to touch Alara's longer hair, which she had recently dyed in aqua blue, finding it complemented the glowing runes of her armor. Alara felt embarrassed for this small vanity, but she saw no disapproval in her friend's eyes. Looking her over, Alara saw a number of other small but definite signs of the years that had passed. When they had parted, neither had been at their full growth. Jairus had gained at least an inch, perhaps two, and while slim, her form suggested a woman more than a girl. It made Alara wonder how she looked in Jairus's eyes. She knew she had also grown and become stronger. She stood now almost 5 inches taller than Jairus, who nonetheless carried herself with the confident assurance of a named assassin.
"Have you been following me?"
Alara asked suddenly, remembering her previous thoughts. Again, Jairus laughed and said,
"Yes, I've actually been here training for several weeks."
Seeing the look on Alara's face, she continued,
"I'm sorry I did not come to you before, but I was worried the reunion might distract us both. I couldn't resist seeing you now. I wanted to see if I could sneak up on you. You made it difficult. Several times I thought you had me."
Despite the playful tone, there was a tension in her voice that caught Alara's attention. She could still read her friend, despite so much time apart.
"What is it? Why search me out?" "The training is being accelerated, and not just mine. You will see more familiar faces here soon. Everyone is preparing. Things are changing quickly, as I'm sure you know."
Lara shook her head, feeling that familiar sensation of being left out. Myolir had barely said a word to her since their confrontation, and she had been giving him his space. None of the other mage hunters took her into their confidence. Now that Jairus had mentioned it, she considered there had been increased traffic through the grounds in the last 2 weeks. She had been so focused on her own training, so accustomed to her isolation, that she had not thought to consider the cause. Seeming startled at her ignorance, Jairus pulled her out of the path of several others to speak in low but intense tones.
"Listen. Eris has returned and spoken to the Nine Voices. You know who she is, I hope."
Alara snapped.
"I'm not utterly ignorant. Yes, I know of the Angel of Retribution. Of course. I don't know many details, and everything I've heard is rumor, so bear that in mind. But word is spreading like wildfire that Eris discovered proof of the existence of Nysir, the Sire of Winter. The god is said to be alive, but frozen, protected within a vault that is now in the hands of thieves, sheltered by the government of Gaedor."
Her eyes blazed. Alara felt a shock travel straight through her.
"Lylas for Vend."
The prayer emerged reflexively from her lips.
"Can it be true?"
Jairus shrugged and said,
"I don't know. But something is happening, and the entire retribution gathers for war. What's more, several of the Halatir have openly declared for our cause. House Shaeil, of course, but also House Nayar."
The Halatir were the high houses that governed Ios. Given the retribution had long languished in the shadows, its membership little better than outlaws, this was big news. House Shaeil had long supported their cause by providing myrmidons in secret, but had never openly endorsed them. Jairus continued,
"It is certain we will take action, and soon."
Alara felt wonder, having difficulty imagining the scope of what Jairus described. Such events could change the entire face of Ios, if not Cain itself. More than this, she felt a budding seed of hope. If Nysir had been found, what of Lylas? They would have to take things one step at a time, but she could not help but imagine the ripples of similar hopes this news would send through Ios. She brought herself back to her current task.
"I must get to my next exercise."
She shook her head, still feeling overwhelmed.
"You will soon leave to join the front lines, while I am trapped here."
Jairus gave a slyer smile and leaned closer to speak quietly.
"I can't say much, but everything is accelerating. I will not be the only one sent forth to fight for our sect. I am not supposed to speak to you about it, but your crucible is soon."
She gripped Alara's hands in hers and gave them a squeeze.
"Now we must part. Good luck, Alara. I hope to fight by your side soon, as we dreamed of when we were younger."
With that, she was away, pulling up her hood and slipping into the shadows with an ease Alara envied. Alara stared after her for several long seconds, her sense of urgency outweighed by a gamut of complex emotions. Part 3. Beyond the Western Border of Ios. Less than a week later, Alara rode out from the hold alongside mage hunters who were strangers to her. She was reminded of being collected from the fane below the ruins of Shaelvis, except those older and grizzled mage hunters had been quiet and grim. These ones were young and energetic, even irreverent, prone to odd humor and telling stories in a familiar shorthand that left Dalara confused. They had that easy familiarity that suggested they had fought and faced the possibility of death together many times. Though they were youthful, several already had battle scars. Leading them was a similarly young but accomplished warcaster named Kalissa, into whose charge Alara had been placed. Before she was sent forth, Kaldikin Sinvisuthir had summoned her to speak with him in the Holdfane, bidding her equip her warcaster armor and bring her weapons and all she owned. It had been a foreboding order, which combined with the austere but holy surroundings to make her feel unsettled and vulnerable. She still did not feel entirely comfortable within the temple devoted to Syra, as though her allegiance to a different goddess made her unwelcome. For the respect she owed the goddess of spring, Alara did offer her prayers when she entered. She was directed to a small, empty second-floor chamber with smooth walls and floors, where a simple bench was situated below a large aperture. Through this could be seen the main statue of the goddess, sculpted within the small central courtyard below that was open to the sky. A carefully tender garden with Syra at the center filled the courtyard, and a profusion of leafy vines climbed the stone walls and sent runners deep within the surrounding fane. The depiction of Syra here was quite different from what she had seen in her original fane in Iris, or in the capital where she slept, watched over by attendants. The statue of Syra here stood in a fierce pose, sword upraised, her body armored for war. This was Syra in her guise as Avenger of the Vanished, the Retribution's goddess. The Kaldikin had been looking on the statue but turned to greet her. He did not take long in getting to the point.
"Ilara," he said, "your time with me is coming to an end. But there is one topic I thought we should discuss before you enter the last phase of your training."
"Of course, Kaldikin."
"There is something I have observed that troubles me, and which I believe lies at the root of many of your difficulties. Your anger. You are too often ruled by it. Do you disagree?"
Ilara had not been expecting this sort of conversation and was caught off guard. Still, she felt in no position to deny him.
"No, I do not."
She looked down at the stone tiles beneath her feet. She said,
"I have sought to demonstrate proper discipline."
He ignored this.
"What lies at the root of your anger?"
"Nothing. I don't know,"
she said, feeling honestly confused. She had never given it any thought.
"Is it some difficulty with your peers? I know most of our brothers and sisters remain aloof. Is it some failing that we, your instructors, must take responsibility for? No?"
She shook her head and his voice became gentler.
"Come, Ilara, let us speak without the barriers of rank between us, as when I first collected you from the Fane of Lylas. Tell me, why is it I never hear you speak of your parents?"
The question took her entirely by surprise. She blinked at him, feeling a tightness in her throat.
"Why would I speak of them, Kaldikin? I never knew them. They are nothing to me."
"I don't think that's true. Even when we do not know our parents, they define us. I find it difficult to believe you have never considered them. Certainly Domine Hyseith told you who they were, as best she knew. All orphans who go to the third chamber are allowed to know their origins."
"She told me," Ilara allowed. "But still, I have no feelings toward them. They were unremarkable."
Sinvis turned back toward the courtyard, folding his arms and looking serenely down upon his goddess. He said,
"Tell me, how did they die?"
Ilara began to feel her blood stirring again. She disliked being manipulated, and it was worse from the Kaldikin, who had treated her with considerable kindness.
"You know how they died."
"I want to hear it in your words. Answer."
The tone of command entered into his voice. She sighed and said,
"They foolishly chose to leave Ios and live among the humans."
Her voice was neutral, as if relating any other fact she had learned in a lecture or from a book.
They were likely members of the Seeker sect. I was told they lived in a community of Iosan exiles in western Signar, near the city known as Serral. Humans killed them for refusing to give up some of their own who were accused of crimes. They thought they could live in peace with humanity, far from Ios, and were murdered for it. They were naive, stupid.
She lost her neutral tone and stopped. The Keldeacon looked at her over his shoulder.
There is no shame in admitting it. You are angry with them. You despise them for their choices.
She swallowed and said,
Yes, I suppose I do. They were fools. But I have put them behind me. I am not like them.
No, you are not. Still, it is important that you face these feelings and understand their origins. You must know your anger if it is not to rule you. Anger can be useful if harnessed. It can be a fire to keep your purpose lit. Let me tell you a few things you may not know. First, your parents were not stupid. They were very intelligent, good people. They sought a solution to the doom facing Syra, clues of the vanished. They wished a better life for you, a future. They were misguided and, yes, naive, but their intentions were noble.
She was not sure what to make of his words. The last thing she had expected was for him to speak well of her parents.
Little good it did them, or anyone, she said at last.
That is true,
Sinvis agreed.
But my point remains. Your parents had courage, and this was displayed in their final moments. The community where they lived also contained a safe house for the Retribution. Some of our brothers and sisters had been on a vital mission and returned there. They were not cautious enough, and were followed. Mercenaries hired by the Fraternal Order of Wizardry, one of our greatest enemies, marched into the village and demanded those they sought be handed over. Your parents were foremost among those who refused, even though they did not agree with our cause. They would not allow fellow Iosans to be given to certain execution. For this, they were murdered. They were soon avenged by the same Retribution agents who had taken shelter there. It was also those agents who found you and returned you to Ios, to your new home within the third chamber.
Lara felt stunned. It was a great deal to absorb, and her feelings were conflicted.
I did not know this, she said. At least not all of it.
I thought you should be aware of the full story, so you could make your own decision about your parents and whether they are deserving of hatred. If you ask me, they were admirable in their own way. I cannot blame them for seeking a better future for their daughter. Retain your anger, but harness it for our cause, directed at those who are truly worthy of hatred. It is humanity that brought us to this. They may seem like us on the surface, but they are a selfish and loathsome race, destructive, short-sighted, and malignant. Their use of magic brought doom to our gods and threatens our extinction. They must be stopped. Soon you will be in a position to face them, to take life. When you look at your first enemy, you will see someone familiar, someone who may not seem so terrible. It may cause you to hesitate. I ask only that you remember your anger. Remember your parents and what they endured. Do not hesitate. Each kill you commit for us is righteous, sanctified by Syra, who avenges the vanished, and also by the memory of her sister Lilas, who gladly destroyed the enemies of the Divine Court.
His words had a powerful impact on her, and she felt her heart beating fast, her blood surging in her veins.
I will not hesitate. I am not sure I am ready, but I promise to do my best.
The Chaldean smiled and walked over to her to place a hand on each shoulder.
None of us is ever ready when called, but the worthy rise to the occasion. I have faith in you.
Shortly thereafter, he introduced her to Calissa, also known as Night's Whisper, who to Alara seemed surprisingly young. The Strike Force leader had welcomed her warmly and took her from the mountain fortress. In the days since that meeting, while they traveled west, Alara had learned directly from her, spending time talking about what it was like to control multiple Myrmidons in battle and to call on one's arcane powers amid a chaotic tumult. The lessons were not so different from what she had been taught by the Chaldean, but centered on Calissa's experiences in the field, particularly from when she had been a Tyro. They also spent time working on Alara's magic and her ability to direct the Myrmidon while distracted. Together with the strikers and infiltrators that made up Calissa's escort, there were among them several newly trained mage hunters, Gyrus among them. She avoided Alara and did not speak to her. This did not trouble the aspiring Tyro, as she sensed her friend was going through her own rites of acceptance among the others as a freshly trained assassin. It did not occur to her that there might be more to this reticence until several days later, when they neared the western Iosan border. There had been no talk of their destination, and for a time, Alara wondered if they might be returning to the third chamber, a thought that filled her with homesickness. During a stop, Calissa bade her stand still and close her eyes, and a blindfold was tied tightly around her eyes. She was told to release her mind from the Myrmidon with which she had been training, and she was assisted back into the saddle. Soon she was led onward in silence, as all conversation and banter between the other mage hunters ceased. In fact, she heard no indication any of them were present, and her augmented senses told her there was only Calissa, who was leading her forward. The rest had scattered. She felt a rising tension and berated herself for being a fool in not anticipating this before. She was about to endure her crucible. This was clearly the entire reason Calissa had taken her from the hold. From the smells in the air and the shifting sounds of other living creatures, Alara felt certain they had entered the lands of mankind. It was not long before Calissa bade her dismount and in low tones gave her brief instructions.
After I leave you, count to 1,000 and then remove the blindfold. You will see a dirt road ahead. Follow it to the right, and you will soon come upon a neglected farm. The house there is presently used as a meeting place for armed patrols of the Lely's resistance. You are familiar with that group, I trust?
Alara nodded, having learned about many human organizations. The Lely's Resistance was an insurgent group fighting the integration of Lael into the Kaedoran Empire. She knew cells existed in each of the major cities in Lael, where they operated in a style not entirely unlike the Retribution. She could not help but feel some small sympathy for them and their seemingly doomed struggle. They still held the sparsely populated southeastern corner of Lael, where they possessed some military strength, supported by gun mages and other arcanists, including a few warcasters. They faced enemies who were much more powerful, enemies with greater resources, numbers, and strength of arms. So far as Alara understood, destroying the resistance was not a priority for the Retribution, although their use of arcanists made them eligible targets when encountered. Calissa continued,
"Your primary objective is to retrieve a satchel held within that farmhouse. It contains correspondence with intelligence vital to upcoming operations, observations of Kaedoran patrols. You can expect to encounter armed members of the resistance. You will be on your own and outnumbered, and you should try to avoid confrontation. Once you have the satchel, return to the woods, and we will meet you. Understood?"
Alara nodded, her mind racing. Calissa slipped away, and she began counting. As she counted, she considered how little she knew about the Crucible. No one would speak to an aspiring Tyro about it. All she knew was things rarely went as expected. Her orders had been unexpectedly simple. She was particularly surprised the challenge did not involve leading a team of mage hunters, given the difficulties she had encountered commanding them during training. She felt relieved to be on her own, as she did not want the added burden of lives reliant on her decisions. Her heart was pounding at the thought of facing armed humans. She had not anticipated this sort of trial, with her life on the line. In retrospect, there was a logic to it. They had to test her in a real situation, not the fabricated scenarios she had faced at the hold. But she had only her Worcester armor and her weapons, along with some few supplies in the pouches at her waist. Was she to be given no Myrmidon? Why had Kalissa focused so intently on those lessons? At the count of 1,000, she removed the blindfold to find herself alone in a small copse of trees adjacent to a well-worn dirt road, its surface marred by deep ruts from wagon wheels. Beyond this were dry grasslands broken up by fenced farmland. The lay of the land was strange, utterly unlike the Iosan interior. She looked behind her and saw in the near distance a heavy line of thicker trees extending as far as she could see in either direction. That way was the Iosan border. Ilara followed the road to the right as Kalissa had instructed, although she kept to the low ditch beside it, obscured by tall grasses. It made traveling less comfortable and her footing uncertain, but she would not be easily seen by anyone using the road. She knew her Iosan armor would mark her as a foreigner well before they saw her face or her sharply pointed ears. She found herself wishing she were wearing something akin to the earth-tone leathers and cloaks of the mage hunters, which would make it easier to blend into her surroundings. She encountered no traffic on the road, and after traveling furtively for almost an hour, she saw the farmhouse ahead, down a short side road and overlooking fields that had clearly gone wild. Away from the house and closer to the field was another large structure, a barn perhaps. She crept closer, wary of walking into the open during daylight and keeping to the undergrowth on the far side of the road. She could see a number of people by the barn and in the open yard outside the house. She determined it would be wise to find a good vantage point and hunker down until darkness, when she might be able to approach unseen. In the meantime, she would try to get a better sense of how many people were there. Well before sundown, a pair of human men in piecemeal armor came hurrying from the road on foot toward the farmhouse, approaching from the opposite direction Ilara had. She watched them closely as they neared the house. One of them waved to someone she couldn't see, perhaps a sentry on the second floor of the barn, then continued up the porch to pound on the door. Some of the humans in the yard approached him, likely to ask him questions. She was too far away to hear what they were saying, but several more individuals came out of the house to listen to the armored human. Then all the humans congregated in the yard, talking and gesturing. Two of them went to the barn, threw open the main doors, and soon emerged with a wide wagon hitched to a pair of draft horses. It was clearly intended for hauling supplies. As the wagon began to move toward the road, a small group of humans joined it as escort. A woman joined the driver up front, and another man in nicer clothing than the others jumped on the back. The rest walked alongside. Altogether, two women and six men went with the wagon. All were armed, with four of the men and one of the women also wearing mixed armor, which looked like boiled leather reinforced by metal plating. One man wore a breastplate and pauldrons, and another had metal greaves and vambrises. All of it looked scavenged and ill-fitting. Ilara faced her first significant decision. Her mission objective was in the house, which should be easier to secure without these humans present. Still, she was reluctant to approach the house during daylight, and she was keenly interested in this expedition and its goal. She had seen one of the returning men pointing up the road, and the entire group seemed excited. She could not be certain, but she did not think they were traveling far. They carried no food, clothing, or other supplies. She decided to follow the wagon and its escorts. If she became convinced they intended a longer journey, she could return here. She kept some distance from the road, staying low and obscured by foliage and trees, as the mage hunters had taught her. The humans did not seem particularly wary and were focused on the road ahead. Ilara felt bold enough to close the distance to get a better look at them. She pulled her goggles down over her eyes to gain the benefit of their augmented lenses. They would be most useful at night, when they would make it easier to see in limited light, but they also offered a slight magnification that brought the wagon and its occupants closer in stark relief. She had never seen humans before. Fascinated, she examined their features, their clothing, and their armor and weapons. She had expected their ears, which were small and oddly nub-shaped, but other details surprised her. First, most looked young, if descriptions she had read were any indication. The men had scruffy, unkempt faces, but not full beards or mustaches. Most were also lean and ragged, their faces soiled and their hair tangled. She would have hazarded none of them had had a decent meal in days. They seemed altogether unclean and repulsive. The only one who bore himself with any dignity was the lightly armored man in the back of the wagon. His face was clean, and his clothing seemed better quality than the rest, dark garments of finer cloth. He wore a ring on his right hand. She froze as she saw him draw a pistol that had been holstered at his waist, its grip gleaming in the sunlight. A moment later he checked along its barrel, polished it with his sleeve, then opened an ammunition wheel to look inside. It seemed more a habit than anything prompted by a sense of alarm. As he holstered the gun, she got a better look at its barrel, and what she saw gleaming there caused her heart to hammer in her chest. Distinct runes were inscribed along its length. There could be little doubt the man was a gunmage, a warrior who combined magic with firearms. This meant he was one of the arcanists whose very existence contributed to whatever ailment beset Syra and had befallen the vanished. She saw the driver gesture ahead, and the group looked where he indicated, picking up the pace even as he flicked his reins to urge the horses on. They were nearing their destination. Ilara risked running forward to keep up, veering away from the road and down the gradual slope there to remain out of sight. She circled warily in a wider arc toward what had drawn their attention. She could hear the sound of the creaking wagon's wheels change as it left the road and entered the softer earth and grass beyond. Moving cautiously, she ascended the slight rise and at last caught sight of what appeared to be a broken and overturned wagon. It had been toppled and its wheels shattered. The humans were gathering around something that had spilled from the back, half covered by a beige cloth tarp. They spoke in excited tones. Ilara knew the basics of their language, but found their speaking too muffled and indistinct to understand what they said. Creeping forward and circling to her left, she was finally able to catch sight of what they were inspecting. Her eyes widened, and she had to grit her teeth to prevent the reflexive gasp. There, tumbled on its side on the ground, was an inert Aspis, one of the light myrmidons employed both by the Iosan Home Guard Coalition and in smaller numbers by the Retribution of Syra. There was no mistaking its curved, white-lacquered armor plates, the turquoise markings of its arcanical power conduits, and the chromed steel joints visible between the creamy white armor. It looked badly out of place here on the ground in this dry and featureless countryside. Her mind raced. Ilara did not for a moment believe this was a coincidence, an abandoned but apparently undamaged myrmidon here just as she was undertaking the crucible. No, this was part of her trial. It seemed reckless of the third chamber to leave the priceless machine here, but there was no other explanation. The Aspis was functional. She could sense its active cortex, though she would be unable to control it until she could come into direct contact with it. The humans were clearly trying to determine the best way to haul the myrmidon onto the flat deck of their wagon. Several uncoiled lengths of rope, and one began to thread the end of one through a sizable pulley attached to a cross brace across the top of the wagon. It looked as though they were prepared for a job of this nature, although she expected they were going to have considerable difficulty. Though it was a light myrmidon, the Aspis was 9 feet tall and its weight was considerable. She could not sit idle, not if there was any chance they might steal the myrmidon. The thought of allowing a piece of Iosan technology to be left with these humans was unthinkable. Myrmidons had been employed only infrequently outside of Ios, and then in controlled situations. Humanity knew little of their capabilities. The Retribution had been careful to employ them only when they could eliminate all witnesses, an edge the sect would surely exploit in days to come. As unlikely as it seemed that these people were capable of understanding an aspis by studying it, others might be more able. Either way, they had to be stopped. Angry, she strongly desired to rush them now and cut them down. The thought sparked excitement within her. The gun mage in particular was a tantalizing target, but he also represented considerable peril. She did not fear death, but she did fear failure, and the odds here were not in her favor. All these humans were armed, and they looked desperate. The Lely's resistance was not to be underestimated, or so those who had instructed her had insisted. She knew better than to discount these people for being human or young. Chances were good several or all had seen real combat. Alara, on the other hand, had not. She felt ready, honed, having prepared her entire life for the moment she would wield the blade to kill a human mage. But preparation was not reality. She needed a distraction. Hollister Griven knew they had stumbled onto something special the moment he spotted the overturned wagon just off the road. He had taken only a brief look under the tarp, enough to see a machine unlike anything he had ever encountered, at which point he had rushed to get help. There had been no corpses around the wagon and limited signs of violence. Whatever had happened, those who owned this thing might return at any moment. Now he was puzzling over the best way to use their rope and the pulley to haul the great machine onto their own wagon. Before the war, he had apprenticed under a mechanic in Meriwen, and he had spent considerable time learning how to work a forge in the attached smithy. He was a large man, well-muscled, and in more recent years he had learned to fight. Despite what other people might think of his looks, he was smart and had a knack for problem-solving. He had enough training in basic engineering that he was certain he could puzzle this out. He knew a number of useful knots, and he set to creating a harness around the machine's upper torso, although its oversized shoulder armor made this a challenge. "What we really need is a crane," he mumbled under his breath. "Yes, a steam-powered crane would be quite handy," came the sardonic reply from the gun mage Jasmir Delawayne, who wasn't making himself very useful in Hollister's opinion. He lounged against the wagon with arms folded, a self-confident smirk on his face. "Unfortunately, we'd have to send to Raiden for that."
"What do you think it is?"
This came from Nyla Swin, a tall and broad-shouldered farm girl who had proven to have a knack for swinging a sword. She wore her armor with greater ease than any of them, including Hollister, and had proven to be a natural soldier.
"A warjack, clearly," Hollister said. "Has to be."
Nyless was staring at it with a frown, tilting her head, and she shook her head.
"Don't look like any warjack I've seen. Who makes them like that?"
"I have no clue."
"I guarantee you they'll want to see this in Raiden. Someone there will know what it is."
He grunted as he sought to feed the rope underneath the machine.
"Give me a hand here."
"Smoke!"
This was shouted by Giles Trevon, the driver, who had been up on the back of the wagon to help feed the rope through the pulleys. He pointed to the northeast, where a thickening plume of black smoke rose from over the next hill.
"Looks close! Fire? That could be bad. This area's real dry. Hasn't had rain in weeks."
Hollister let go the rope. He stood with a frown, shading his eyes to peer at the smoke. Jasmir was standing alert, one of his pistols in hand and all hint of his former posturing gone. As annoying as the man could be at times, Hollister knew he was deadly with his rune-inscribed bullets, and he was glad to have him here. The gun mage said,
"Something might be coming our way. James, Laughlin, Lauren, Kyle, let's take a look. The rest of you, stay on your toes."
"We should really get this thing up on the wagon," Hollister insisted, but he saw the gun mage was in no mood to negotiate.
Jasmir and the others drew their weapons and moved as quietly as possible toward the smoke. Atop the wagon, Giles picked up his old rifle, cracked the breech to ensure it was loaded, and snapped it shut. They all waited. Hollister sighed but saw there was nothing to it but to be patient. He wished he'd thought to bring a Huaga cigar to calm his nerves. At times like these, his thoughts turned to the rest of his family back in Raiden, where they had fled after the war brought Kaedorans to the capital. Before the siege of Meriwen, he had wanted to stay in that city, to volunteer to defend the walls. His father would have none of it, saying he was too young, with a proper life ahead of him still. Then they had fled to Raiden. His family was still there, with barely enough to eat, likely wondering when he would return safe. He looked down to the strange warjack they had found and smiled, anticipating he could leverage the find to get his family extra food rations at least. Maybe a better sword, a pistol, and some quality boots for him, too. He had a sudden bad feeling, and his hand went to the hilt of the blade at his waist. "Did you hear something?" Facing him, Nylesh shook her head. "No." "What?" Her eyes widened as she pointed with the readied blade. She hissed, "Where behind?" He was already drawing his blade as he turned. He took in the sight of a strangely tall and exotic-looking Iosan woman rushing through the tall grasses from downslope at him. He had little time to gather an impression other than her face was beautiful and terrible all at once. Her eyes were fixated on him and her expression was cold. Her hair was a strange shade of blue, and in her hands were a pair of wickedly curved bladed weapons, unlike anything he had ever seen. Then she was upon him. He raised his sword defensively, but she hooked it aside with the sickle blade in her left hand, throwing him off balance. Her right hand swept toward him. It was like time slowed as he saw it coming, but there was nothing he could do to avoid it. She struck underhanded, slashing the hooked point up and into his abdomen. Its razor-sharp edge cut through the hardened leather of his armor with no resistance, and he felt the cold metal ripping into his belly. He gasped in surprise as she yanked upward, and he felt something inside him give way, followed by a flood of warm wetness and an explosion of pain. Then the cutting edge of the blade in her left hand returned and sliced coldly across his neck. He saw and felt no more, but only gurgled as he toppled forward. The blood was what shocked Alara the most, the sheer quantity of it, along with the smell and heat as she cut the man open. She stepped back and away as he tumbled like a butchered sow. Heart hammering, she felt the strange euphoria, but also a sickness in her gut. She had not hesitated, but she was not unfazed. It seemed her training should have prevented the sinking feeling she had inside, the desire to retch. Hot blood and viscera had spilled from him, and her blades and part of her armor were stained red. She felt something else, too, a strange rush of power, the sensation of his life force drawn into her as she took a deep breath. Her weapons vibrated and felt warm in her hands. She did not have time to consider this. The woman standing behind the man she had killed gave a half-choked cry and rushed at her. She was broad of shoulder and almost as tall as Alara, but heavier. Her face was red and distorted with rage. Alara stepped to the side and let the woman rush by where she almost tripped over the Myrmidon. Alara felt her pulse racing and knew she had to activate the machine. Everything was happening too quickly. She should have struck out, torn open the woman as she went by, but she had not. A mistake. "Stay back, Nylas! Let me shoot!" the man on the wagon shouted in Lelis. He raised his rifle, the barrel wavering unsteadily. Alara leapt to the side as he pulled the trigger. She invested all her gathered arcane strength into her power field. The bullet went wide and disappeared into the grass. The sound of the rifle firing was loud, very loud. Alara growled and leapt up onto the back of the wagon. None of this was proceeding as she had imagined when she started that fire, but it was too late to second-guess herself. The driver had opened the breech of his rifle and was fumbling with another cartridge, trying to insert it even as she came at him. He gave a strangled yelp, dropped the cartridge, and lurched forward, swinging the gun at her like an awkward club. She ducked and stepped close to him, well inside his reach. Standing tall, she brought one of her blades up and then slashed down, burying its point into the top of his skull and penetrating deep into his cranium, where it stuck. She looked away in disgust as she yanked the blade free of his skull while he shuddered and convulsed. She then leapt down over the side of the wagon nearest to the downed Myrmidon, finding Nyleth waiting. The woman held her sword well and lunged at Alara in a fencer's pose, seeking to skewer her with the point. Still rattled, Alara barely deflected it in time, finding her legs did not feel steady. The woman struck again, this time in a downward diagonal slash. Alara got a blade under it, but underestimated the woman's strength, so her own blade came back toward her and her power field shimmered and sparked as it sought to deflect it. The woman used the momentum from her first swing to launch a perfect backhanded slash. The unexpected